This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Zach Galifianakis, stars in the new FX comedy series Baskets. He co-created the show with Louis C.K., who also is one of the executive producers. Galifianakis co-starred in the Hangover movies, and in Birdman, he played the producer and right-hand man of Michael Keaton's character. Galifianakis created the web series Between Two Ferns, a satirical interview show on the Funny or Die website, in which he plays the disaffected host who asks inappropriate questions to his celebrity guests. In Galifianakis' new series, Baskets, he plays Chip Baskets, whose dream is to be an artistic, poetic clown. In the opening episode, he's studying in Paris at a French clown academy. But he doesn't speak French and has no idea what is being said. So he's learning nothing. That's typical of how his life is going. He returns home to Bakersfield, California, is staying at a cheap, run-down motel, and can't even afford that. Terry spoke with Galifianakis last Wednesday and began with a scene from the first episode, where he interviews for a job as a rodeo clown at a small-time local rodeo.
It says here that you studied clowning at the Clown Frances. Academy de Clown Frances.
That's correct, at the Academy de Clown and Francois.
Baskets? Oh, my God. What a name for a clown.
That's my real name. That's my...
You're Baskets Clown now, Pally.
I have another clown name, and I prefer to go by that, if you don't mind.
Okay. Well, what's your clown name?
My clown name is Renoir.
What?
Renoir.
Can't have no clown here named Renoir. You're Baskets. Baskets Clown. You know how many of you clowns end up in the basket? That's the most perfect clown name I ever heard.
Great.
You're hired.
I am?
Sure. Don't take nothing to get hired around here other than walk in that door right there and tell me you're damn fool enough to want the job.
Thank you very much.
I don't pay enough. Mm-hmm. They all quit. You'll quit too.
I'll take it.
Okay. Care for a cup of coffee before you leave?
No, I'm okay, thank you.
Okay, well, get on out there. Headbutt me some bulls.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Headbutt me some bulls. That's where keep them stands filled, the Raptors. Yeah.
Zach Galifianakis, welcome to Fresh Air. I always thought there was something really sad about clowns. I never really liked clowns as a kid. I thought I was supposed to, but I didn't. And I thought there's something really off-putting about clown suits. So I'd like to know what your position is about clowns.
I'm not really creeped out by clowns. I remember seeing Shortcuts. There was a Robert Altman movie, and there was a female clown in that. And it was just kind of a matter of fact, you know, she was a clown that just went and performed at kids' birthday parties. Kind of a regular, you know, existence. And that to me is more interesting, is just, you know, people that actually have to do it, not the weird extremes clowns can be. Or how they are portrayed. I think it's kind of more interesting to see the boring clown sometimes, and to see him with his makeup on and shopping for cheese is kind of the clown world that we wanted to paint. This guy is a clown accidentally. When he's trying to be a clown at the rodeo, he's not very good. But when he's out in the real world, he falls down a lot or things happen to him, but he's not trying to be a clown. And that's kind of the thing that's the dark cloud that's over him all the time, is he can't be a clown when the lights are on him. He can only accidentally be a clown. And that was kind of an interesting thing to me, too.
Your character's mother is played by comic Louis Anderson. He's great in this. And, you know, it's a really unusual casting choice. Louis Anderson is a very large male who's playing your mother. And, yeah. You know, he's wearing like a house dress. But he's not, you know, going out of his way to look, quote, female. Do you know what I mean? He has, you know, what we think of as a woman's hairdo, but he's not changing his voice. I don't know if he's changing his manner much. And somehow it really works. And, like, why did you think of casting him?
Well, it kind of went down like this. Louis C.K. and I were at my house, and we were chatting about an actress And I originally had tried to get an actress named Brenda Blethyn, I think that's how you pronounce her name, who is an English actress, and she was not available. And Louis and I are chatting, and I say to Louis, it's a voice that I keep hearing in my head, and I imitated the voice, and he said, you mean like Louis Anderson's voice? And I said, yes. And he said, well, should we call him? And I said, yes. And within 5 minutes, he was cast on the show. And it was one of those things that you kind of get a gut feeling inside of you and you just kind of run with it. And we got really lucky because we didn't even know it, but Louis Anderson had been channeling his mom in his stand-up act for a few years. So he came with this whole character already formed. We didn't have to do anything. The first day of the shoot, though, he had a lot of makeup on, and I just remember saying to the makeup people, he doesn't need any. We don't want to make it cartoonish. This is an homage. It's not a, you know, we're not drag queening him up. And Louis just is very subtle, and, you know, he's heartbreaking in the show. We're lucky to have him.
The way Louis Anderson plays him, he's always conveying a combination of sympathy and complaint at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we hear Louis Anderson in the role? So this is a scene from Baskets, and your character, Chip Baskets the Clown, can't pay the rent at the cheap motel he's been living in. And he and his insurance agent and kind of maybe friend Martha come to visit his mother, Christine Baskets, who's played by Louis Anderson. And they're all sitting in front of the TV together. The mother has been watching one of the home shopping networks. And you've really come there to try to hit her up for some money.
I'll tell you one thing. I'm not paying any money to those foreigners who run that flea bag motel.
Mom, I'll pay you back, okay?
I guess you could move in here until you get on your feet.
I appreciate the invitation, but I am a grown man.
What about you and Martha starting a greeting card company? Have you seen the cost of greeting cards? I paid $5 for a get-well card.
Mom, I have a job. I'm a clown. I just don't have the money.
You know, Chip, jobs are supposed to pay the bills. That's why they're called jobs.
Use this on a bagel. How's that for cutting a bagel thin, huh? Pretty good?
What about Arby's? Everyone's happy at Arby's. Plus, bonus, curly fries.
That is a good bonus.
Do you love them?
I do love them.
What do you dip yours in?
Ketchup, sometimes with blue cheese dressing.
Oh, a mixer.
Yeah.
Wow, she's a wild one, Chip. What's the seasoning on there? I'm thinking paprika.
Okay, so that's Louis Anderson as the mother in Baskets. We also heard Zach Galifianakis playing Chip the Clown, and Martha Kelly playing his friend Martha. You were in Birdman, which was such a wonderful film. And one of the things that made Birdman special is the really long tracking shots in which all the action had to be precisely choreographed because it was like, you know, what was the longest take? It was several minutes, right? And there's always like characters walking in and out of the frame. Do you have anything you could describe for us about working in that kind of context where a take had to work for a really long time and everything had to be so precisely choreographed so it was in the frame at exactly the right time?
Well, you know, it's like a baton being handed off to you when it's your turn, you know, and you don't want to drop it because then everybody else has lost the race, if you want to put it that way. So the stakes were high, and I kind of felt out of place because, again, my confidence level is not huge, and I'm more of a stand-up comic, and I'm with these serious actors. But I noticed that Naomi Watts didn't have any confidence either, and that made me feel really good because, you know, she was very vulnerable when she was working, I found, and that made me feel really good. So it was a group thing. You know, everybody was there to help each other. And it was very choreographed. I mean, you don't get a lot of rehearsal time sometimes in acting, but we rehearsed this a lot, and there was 2 weeks of rehearsal. They measured off the theater in New York, the St. James. We rehearsed it in Los Angeles, so the measuring of the hallways were precise. So the camera guys would come, and we would do this little dance for 2 weeks. So when we got to New York, we knew exactly what we were doing. So it was pretty choreographed, and it needed to be because there was a lot of tricky things to figure out in those shots. The crew, to me, is those guys are the real stars of those scenes. You don't get to see them, obviously, but the work they did is just tremendous.
So there's one more clip I want to play of your work, and this was from when you got to interview President Obama on your Funny or Die. Funny or Die is a comedy website with a whole lot of comic material on it, and you have a web series on there called Between Two Ferns, in which you play a very inept talk show host who's always asking just like inappropriate, offensive questions to his guests and putting them on the spot in really disturbing ways. So Obama was on your show, and obviously the point of him being there was trying to convince young people that they needed to register for Obamacare. My favorite part of the interview is how the segue is made between this really painful, uncomfortable interview that your character, the interviewer, is having with the President of the United States, the segue from that into the president talking about the importance of registering for the health care insurance. So why don't we hear that section of Zach Galifianakis's interview with President Obama.
Where are you planning on building a presidential library, in Hawaii or your home country of Kenya? Because, I mean, both places seem like they would be...
Zach, that's a ridiculous question.
Well, you know, I mean, not to bring up the birth certificate thing, but you really never did really produce your real...
Where's your birth certificate? Why don't you show it to us right now?
I don't want to show anybody my birth certificate because it's embarrassing.
What's embarrassing about it?
My weight on it, it says that I was born 7 pounds, 800 ounces. You know what I would do if I were president, Mr. President? I would make same-sex divorce illegal, then see how bad they want it.
I think that's why you're not president, and that's a good thing.
You said if you had a son, you would not let him play football. What makes you think that he would want to play football? What if he was a nerd like you?
Do you think a woman like Michelle would marry a nerd? Why don't you ask her whether she thinks I'm a nerd?
Could I?
No, I'm not going to let her near you.
So do you go to any websites that are .coms or .nets, or do you mainly just stick with .govs?
No, actually, we go to .govs. Have you heard of healthcare.gov?
Here we go. Okay, let's get this out of the way. What did you come here to plug?
Well, first of all, I think it's fair to say that I wouldn't be with you here today if I didn't have something to plug. Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. That's the thing that doesn't work. Why would you get the guy that created the Zune to make your website?
Healthcare.gov works great now, and millions of Americans have already gotten health insurance plans, and what we want is for people to know that you can get affordable health care. And most young Americans right now, they're not covered, and the truth is that they can get coverage all for what it costs you to pay your cell phone bill.
Is this what they mean by drones?
Okay, that's Zach Galifianakis and President Obama, recorded in 2014. So how much of that was written in advance? How much did the president know about the questions you were going to ask him? Did he have, like, answers prepared in advance?
Well, when I got there, I asked Cody, his speechwriter, basically what you just asked me. Does he know about the show? Has he seen the questions? And then there was one particular question that I kind of needed to know. Has he seen this question?
So you submitted questions to them?
Yes. I mean, it's the President of the United States. We knew that they had something that they wanted to get out to the public, and they wanted to vet it, but they said no to nothing. They were all gung-ho for everything. So there was really no, you can't say that. There was none of that from them. But I did, when I got to the White House, I did ask Cody, and I pointed to a question that was on a sheet of paper, and I said, yes, but has he seen this question? Which was the question, what's it like to be the last black president? Which was kind of a darker question. And Cody just looked at me and he goes, I think so. Which means, in my mind, of course he didn't see it. So I wasn't 100% sure of what he had seen or not seen or how familiar he was, which I think is probably why I was a bit nervous when I went in to actually, because you want to be respectful, obviously. Everybody knows it's kind of a put on, but it's still, you want to be respectful. So we were told that he, you know, approved of everything. So we just ran with it, and we didn't have him for long at all. We just kind of stuck with it, what was written, and that was, I don't know, 16 minutes with him, maybe?
I'm trying to remember what his answer was to your question. How does it feel to be the last black president?
Well, in the edit, I'm not sure what it was, but he hit me in real life in the face. No, I'm just kidding, Terry. No, I think it was, what's it like to be the last time to talk to a president or something like that, yeah.
That's right. That is what he said. What's it like for this to be the last time you'll ever talk to a president? Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. He should go into comedy when he leaves the White House.
You know, I've said this before, and I don't mean this as an offense. It's just kind of the way it is. D.C. political people are often not funny. They think they are, but they just aren't. I've spent enough time in Washington, D.C., and hear those corny jokes that you hear that, you know, that machine tells sometimes. President Obama is not like that, and I think that's one of the problems that he has with jealousy, meaning I think people are just jealous of that coolness that he has. But, yeah, he has very good timing. Really, really good straight man.
Zach, thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
Terry, I like chatting with you. It's like chatting with an old friend I only talk to once every 7 years.
Zach Galifianakis' new FX comedy series is called Baskets. He spoke with Terry last Wednesday. The HBO series Togetherness starts its second season February 21st. Our next guests, Jay and Mark Duplass, co-created the series. They also write and direct it, and Mark is one of the stars. The Duplass brothers started making films together when they were kids in the 80s, using their dad's VHS camera. They've become known for their lo-fi filmmaking style and have written and directed 5 feature films, including Jeff Who Lives at Home and Cyrus. Both brothers also act. Mark was a series regular on the FX comedy The League and starred in the films Hump Day, Your Sister's Sister, and The One I Love. Jay co-stars in the Amazon series Transparent. Their HBO series, Togetherness, is about 4 people in their late 30s living in Los Angeles. The characters cope with children, marriage, their work lives, and a general sense of feeling lost. The Duplass brothers recently spoke to Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado. They started with a scene from the show. The main couple in the series has just left a marriage counseling session, and the wife has decided they should do something fun, spend the day at the park with adult friends without kids. The husband, played by Mark Duplass, agrees, but it's the last thing he wants to do. He's sitting alone in his car outside the park when his sister-in-law, played by Amanda Peet, comes to the car to fetch him.
Yes, I'm coming. I'll be there in a second.
Let's go.
Wait, hold on. I'm not ready yet. I just need like a second.
Don't do this.
Don't do what? What do you...
This whole mood killer thing, she's so... psyched, and she really needs this day, and she really needs to party and have fun. And if you're gonna be like this, it's gonna ruin it for her.
Okay, I am trying to get myself ready for that, but it's a little hard for me, okay? Do you understand that?
Yeah, I mean, I do, but just fake it. I mean, do you see this smile? Yeah. I'm dead inside.
Jay and Mark Duplass, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having us.
Why did you choose to make a TV show about these 4 characters living in Los Angeles, all in different stages of life, but all kind of lost in searching for something?
We hadn't made a really deeply personal television show or movie in a while. Our first feature we made was called The Puffy Chair, and it was sort of about what our life really felt like in our 20s when we were all kind of dating people for a year or two. And when we came to make Togetherness, we thought, you know, we're hearing lots of conversations about people who are either in their late 30s and married, and they're just an inch from drowning in the sea of their children and their jobs and make everything work, or they haven't found that person yet or haven't even found that traction in their work life.
So one of the things you explore is a marriage, and Michelle and Brett, 2 of the main characters, they're married with 2 children. One of them is just kind of out of the infant stage. Why was that something that interests you in particular?
Mark and I both have kids the same age. They're now roughly 7 and 3. And at that time, we were entering that phase. And there's something very, very specific about when your last baby starts sleeping through the night, where you come out of this fugue state of parenting. And in our case, and in the case of the family on Togetherness, it was a 7-year process. And you feel like, oh my God, that was wonderful. We've come out of it. But now it's been 7 years. I don't really know who I am. And you're looking at your spouse and you're like, I don't know who you are. I don't know really what I like anymore, because all of my needs have been subjugated for the good of these babies and our family unit. And you kind of have to refigure everything out.
Mark, you've said, well, you've both said that you were super close growing up, and you continue to be, but growing up, you guys shared a room and even shared a bed. What was your relationship like when you were kids?
Single bed. Single
yeah,
bed.
We. I was extremely dependent on Jay. He was my spiritual leader. He was my God. He was everything to me. And he was sweet enough to let me play with him because, you know, what brother who has a 4 years his younger little brother wants to hang out with him? So I was really lucky to have that. And, yeah, we would spend the night in the same bed together. I was scared of the dark. Jay would hang out with me. We would talk about how when we grew up we were going to, like, get a house together and, like, kind of thought that our wives would just, like, move into the house with us, which is emotionally still kind of how it is to a certain degree. And then something really interesting happened, which was when I was, like, 14 and Jay was 18, he went to college and had a really hard year and felt very disconnected from home. And then the tables kind of shifted a little bit where I was able for the first time to be strong for Jay and exhibit some level of leadership by just being young and naive enough to just say, it's going to be okay, you're awesome, it's going to be okay. And then we built, during those years, a truly impenetrable bond.
And what kinds of movies and TV did you like when you were kids?
We were in a very specific situation where cable came to our neighborhood in like 1982. And so at that time, HBO was uncurated, so all these movies were coming down the pipeline. And we were watching, like, our friends were really into Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, but I don't know, we just didn't go to movies that much. And so we were just watching whatever showed up on HBO. And at that time, you come home from school and, like, Ordinary People would be on, or Kramer versus Kramer, or Sophie's Choice. Or, like, not just a hard-hitting dramas, but even, like, adult sex comedies like Manhattan and Hannah and Her Sisters and this great adult fare. And our parents did not limit us at all. And Mark and I just, like, went deep on it. We were just obsessed with these movies and honestly weren't that into Star Wars. It seemed a little silly to us even at the time.
Now, Jay, when you and Mark started making movies together, Jay, you were often the director and Mark was often the actor. And Mark, you've also acted in many movies and TV shows. I think that, Jay, people were surprised and very pleased when you became one of the co-stars on the Amazon series Transparent, which
I was surprised,
which released its second season recently. Can you talk about how you became involved in the show? I kind of always assumed that you were reluctant to be an actor.
I wasn't necessarily reluctant to be an actor. It just never occurred to me, honestly. It was more a case of I was our primary camera operator on everything that we've made except for Togetherness. And so I basically met Jill Soloway at a party for directors, where directors sometimes get together because we don't work together on set. It's a way to talk about our process and maybe try and figure out which actors are nice and which actors are mean. And so she was telling me that she had this TV show ready to go and she had the whole family, but she couldn't find the son. It was really troubling her. She needed a mid-30s, wildly insecure / charismatic Jewish guy. And I was like, oh man, those are all Mark's and my friends. We know all the actors in town who fit that bill. And I went through a laundry list of guys and she had considered them all. And then she stopped me after about a half an hour of talking and she said, it's you. She's like, I think you're him and I would like you to come in and read. And I was reluctant. because Mark and I were just starting our show Togetherness, and I was nervous. It was the biggest thing that we'd ever undertaken. Also, I was like, I'm not really an actor. She said, why don't you come in tomorrow morning and read with Gabby Hoffman and Amy Landecker? And I did. We improvised the barbecue dinner scene that's in the pilot of the show. And sometimes when you're on set, like, magic happens and lightning strikes. And it did happen that day. And I felt like I was Gabby and Amy's brother. And we looked alike and we talked alike. And we were not afraid to mess with each other and feel that love underneath it all was still going to be there. It was a very strange and magical experience, which I've come to understand is part of what happens when you work with Jill Soloway. But even when I agreed to do it, you know, most pilots don't go to show. It felt like a small web show, honestly, that was being made like an independent film on the east side of L.A. I had no idea that it would become, you know, the phenomenon that has become, much less a piece of art at the forefront of a civil rights movement.
There are so many great things about Transparent, but one thing I think it gets really right is something you were just talking about, the relationship between the siblings. I think it gets the way that siblings know each other's secrets, which can mean that, you know, siblings can be really supportive of each other, but it also means that they know what might hurt the most, and they can be, you know, how to be the most brutal. And also, siblings, no matter how old they are, can sometimes revert to old patterns, act like they did when they were kids, when they're hanging out with each other. And I'm not sure if you agree with my assessment of how the show treats siblings, but was that something that interests you in the series?
Yeah, I think that was a huge part of it, and probably also part of my conversation with Jill before she said it's you, was we talked about Mark's and my relationship, because Jill has an older sister and they came up in their own little magical world, and it just so happens that Mark and I are kind of like twins, and Gabby is incredibly tight with her sister, who's significantly older than her, but it was kind of like a mother-sister figure with her. And Amy also has a sister that she was incredibly close with. So that was something that I think was critical to the process, is that we all understood that we had to be brutally honest with each other. And I think I do agree with your assessment, and I would probably just add one thing to it. One thing that you do with your siblings when you love them more than life itself is your cruelty can often come from trying to force them to be who they truly are. Sometimes that's nefarious because you may be mistaken about who they are, but you also want them to be the best version of themselves. And so, particularly for Josh, a lot of his difficulty and confusion in life comes from the fact that, you know, he did come up in a household full of incredibly strong women. And I think it was hard for him to find his identity, but also it's probably why he has so much trouble dating, is that he holds everyone to the candle of his sisters, who he worships.
You do such a good job with Josh. Do people often confuse you, Jay, with Josh and think that you might be very similar to him?
I think it's weird sometimes, yes, when people see me in public, because, you know, I've been with my wife for 15 years and we have two kids and I'm a family guy and I'm quiet and reserved, you know. So I am playing a character who's very, very different from me. More than anything, what's interesting about playing Josh is because the Pfeffermans feel so real and are so specific to the east side of L.A., which is where I live, that a lot of times I have people, they'll just start talking to me like they know me, and then they start to realize within a minute that they don't know me and that I'm inside their TV, because the show is so fluid. I mean, I've even had people ask if I'm really Gabby's brother, which is insane. It's like, don't you know how TV works? But people just are really taken by the show and really believe and feel this family.
Jay and Mark Duplass, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Jay and Mark Duplass spoke with Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado last Wednesday. Season 2 of their HBO series Togetherness begins February 21st. Our next guest, Australian filmmaker George Miller, directed one of the movies nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture. Here's a typical scene. The film is Mad Max Fury Road, and calling it a nonstop action film probably understates the case. Richard Brody of The New Yorker said it brings an eyeball-scorching, cornea-melting, socket-shattering intensity. It's earned 10 Oscar nominations, including Best Director. George Miller spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last Monday. Fury Road revives the Mad Max series directed by Miller in the 70s and 80s, all starring Mel Gibson. The new film stars Tom Hardy as Max, along with Charlize Theron as Furiosa, this film's road warrior. It was shot in Namibia and is set in a post-apocalyptic desert world. Theron's character takes to the road in a massive Mack truck-like vehicle called a war rig to escape an evil warlord named Immortan Joe and liberate Joe's 5 young wives. They meet up with Max and are chased through the desert by an armada of vehicles with bizarre armor and weapons. Here's Tom Hardy's opening voiceover from Mad Max Fury Road.
My name is Max. My world is fire and blood.
Why are you hurting these people?
It's the oil, stupid.
Oil wars.
We are killing for gasoline.
The world is actually running out of water.
Now there's the water wars.
Once, I was a cop. A road warrior searching for a righteous cause.
The terminal freakout point.
Mankind has gone rogue, terrorizing itself.
The earth is sour.
Our bones are poisoned.
We have become half-life.
As the world fell, each of us in our own way was broken. It was hard to know who was more crazy. Me. Or everyone else.
And the story begins. George Miller, welcome to Fresh Air. Great to have you. There aren't a lot of quiet moments in this film. We hear Tom Hardy as Max talking there. This is a wild ride of war on wheels, and the vehicles are real, shooting all kinds of weapons, people leaping from one to another, huge cars and trucks and other kinds of vehicles smashing into each other and rolling over at various speeds. You didn't use a lot of computer-generated graphics here, right? Why did you want to actually have these vehicles in the action?
Well, it's a film in which we don't defy the laws of physics. It's real people in a real desert. There's no men in capes flying around or space vehicles and so on. So it wouldn't make a lot of sense to shoot it all digitally, or a large part of it, because it would lose a lot of it authenticity. And it's very, very difficult, despite the amazing advances in 15 to 20 years of the digital world in filmmaking. It's still very difficult to make something feel really authentic. So we chose to do it old school, and that means going out to a remote location with endless desert and have real vehicles and human beings in that landscape and so on.
You know, again and again, you'll see a vehicle of some kind that's chasing a big truck and smashing into the truck, and the truck will wheel over and try and knock the vehicle off the road. These are real vehicles, real people in them. How do you manage that safely?
With a lot of preparation, with a film like this, where it's a long shoot. It's 120 days out there. Every day is a big stunt day. So you have to be almost fanatical about preparation and safety. Otherwise, things could go horribly wrong. And so everything was very well rehearsed, very well prepared. And we had a wonderful stunt crew and rigging crew and effects crew out there. And it got to the point where, with proper preparation, you're able to sort of get the actors who are, all of them, pretty physical, athletic people in a lot of the shots. When there's a moment when you see Max hanging upside down between the wheels of this war rig, inches off the ground.
While it's moving, right?
While it's moving, it's going fairly fast. Well, that's Tom Hardy there. But he has two very, very secure harnesses supporting him, And also, you know, nowadays you can erase them very easily, whereas in the past you couldn't.
You said you can erase them. And that's,
you can erase the hard.
That's where the computer graphics comes in, I guess.
And that's where it comes in. Plus, there's a lot of work creating or enhancing the landscapes. Because the film itself plays out more or less in real time over 3 days and two nights, we're also able to get a consistency in the sky and in the shadows and the landscape. So even though most of it is real world, virtually every shot has CG in it in some way.
So the sky would be colored, or the landscape would be colored, but the cars are really crashing into each other.
Yes. You're also able to erase your previous takes. I used to watch movies when I was younger, and you'd know how many takes people did by the number of skid marks on the road. So we can now erase take 1, 2, and 3 and simply have the skid marks of take 4.
The three previous Mad Max films were centered around Max, and he is a big part in this, but in some respects the hero of this is a woman played by Charlize Theron. You want to talk a little bit about her role in this story and what she brought to the part?
Well, the original idea of this film, given that it was to be a chase, was also that what people were in conflict over was to be human. And in this case, five wives escaping a tyrannical warlord, and they needed a road warrior, and it couldn't be a male because that's a different story, and it had to be female. But she needed to be convincing as a warrior, not just someone masquerading as a warrior. So Charlize actually was the only actor I thought about for this role. She's somebody who's got a lot of stature physically and in her spirit, and she's able to... She's pretty uncompromising. She shaved her hair. She said Furiosa would not worry about hair in the heat and the dust. And required quite a bit of immersion from the actors. And Charlize is one of those people who just was able to do that.
You know, at the heart of the story here, you have a very tough and determined woman who is fleeing this despotic warlord, and in doing so liberating his five wives, essentially women he uses for breeding. Did you think of this as a feminist story when you were writing it?
Not overtly. I was very interested in the character and in the way that the Max stories are told. I mean, basically, they're allegorical stories. In the same way, I guess, that the classic Western was that. And Max is a character who gets swept up into this story. He's that sort of wanderer in the wasteland looking for some sense of meaning in a very stark world. And he gets caught up in their story. And because the MacGuffin, as Hitchcock used to say, the thing that's in conflict, is human and female... It just evolved. The characters go that take you along in the story, and that's sort of the sense that she was somehow a very really interesting action hero, female, just arose organically out of the story. The feminist notions in the movie were the same. It was never... the first agenda of the film. It was always story-driven, and the rest followed.
Well, George Miller, you began your career in a way so many Hollywood folks do, by going to medical school. This is interesting. You grew up in, a rural area of Australia, right, and went to medical school. You worked as an emergency room doctor, is that right?
Well, I did my normal rotations through emergency when I worked in a big city hospital. And once I started making films, I would work weekends in emergency and as doing locums. And then during the week, I grappled with learning how to make movies. I tried that for about a few years, and I ended up basically spending all my time making movies and very little time being a doctor. And I went through medical school with my twin brother, and I realized after about a decade how much I'd lost the practice of medicine. So by default, I became a filmmaker.
Did the things you saw in emergency rooms have anything to do with the Mad Max films, which are, of course, are about mayhem on the highways and some, in great respect?
The very first one was about that. There was something about how we deal with violence in society and how we deal with it in the media that I was very interested in, I guess thematically, but interestingly enough, I was also interested in very kinetic cinema as I was trying to understand what this new language, which is not much more than 100 years old, let's say 120 years old now, the film language is, and it's very universal. It basically was formed in the silent era in the chase films of Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd and the two real westerns. And I really went back and looked at those. I saw, this is in a sense where cinema was forged. So I became very, very interested in the action movie. And those two things drove me to make the first Mad Max in some way.
There's quite a car culture in rural Australia, isn't there?
Yes, we don't have a gun culture, but growing up in remote Australia, the car was the thing. Big expanses of landscape and long straight roads, and as soon as someone could get their hand on a car, I mean, like a lot of rural people were driving, you know, when they were kids already, not on the main roads, of course, but on country properties, and so I remember growing up there, and the car was I don't know, it was a way to get out of town. It was a way to express themselves in some way by doing up cars. It was something that really, really struck me. And then my brothers and I, when my parents took us to the city, and I had an education where, you know, as I said, I ended up working in big city hospitals, and I saw the other side of it as well, the chaos of the vehicles, and, you know, when people were coming into emergencies with really bad injuries and so on. And so that sort of got to me in a way, and I think making the first Mad Max was a way of processing that.
Well, you made the first Mad Max film in 1979. I thought we'd listen to some of the trailer of that film.
They've broken his wife. They've killed his best friend. People don't believe in heroes anymore. They've pushed him too far.
We're gonna give him back to heroes!
Mad Max. The last law in a world gone out of control. Where every day is a duel. Every life is on the line. And every turn in the road brings you face to face with a new kind of terror. Mad Max. Pray that he's out there. Somewhere.
And that is the trailer for Mad Max. Now, the first Mad Max film is not in a, you know, post-apocalyptic nuclear landscape. I mean, society still exists. He's a cop. Kind of a hero, kind of a Western hero fighting bad guys out on the highways. But the bad guys are like these really creepy, sadistic guys, just utterly ruthless and cruel. Where did those characters come from? Were there people like that on the highways in Australia?
No. And unfortunately, I mean, there could be, but not as exaggerated as that. I mean, that story, I initially intended to make it contemporary. That was a very, very low budget film, and it was the first film that I made with my partner Byron Kennedy, and we'd made short films but had never really been on a movie set before, and it was very difficult. We could not afford, if it was a contemporary story, to block off busy streets and have other vehicles and pay location fees for expensive buildings and so on. So the solution was to go to the back streets, the empty back streets, and go to derelict buildings where we didn't have to populate it with anything but our key characters. And in order to make that convincing, and because the story was so hyperbolic that I just simply put the caption in front of it, a few years from now, to imply some dystopian world. And that came out of just simply working with the budget. It wasn't until we made the second film, Road Warrior, that I was suddenly aware that we had unwittingly tapped into a kind of archetype. The first film did extremely well all around the world, and it was recognized, for instance, in Japan. They saw Max as a kind of lone samurai, and the French critics picked up on it and called it a Western on wheels. And in Scandinavia, he was the lone Viking warrior wandering the wasteland. It seemed to have that sort of universal resonance, and that's when the second film became much more consciously mythological in that sense.
When you cast Mel Gibson in the original Mad Max, he was a relatively unknown actor, right? What did you see in him that was right for that role?
Well, he was just out of the National Drama School. He and Geoffrey Rush and Judy Davis were all in the same class. And they were very, very traditional theatre education, basically, because there wasn't really much TV, and certainly there weren't many movies being made at all. And he was 21 when he made the first Mad Max. And all I know is that when we were casting, there was something about him when he walked through the door, but when I saw him perform in the video tests, there was something about it that was very, very convincing. And I really didn't know much about acting, but I was very interested to see what this actor would do next.
Well, George Miller, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
George Miller speaking to Dave Davies last Monday. Miller is the writer and director of Mad Max Fury Road, which is nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancool.